Well, good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this our 13th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the back, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster in the back taking pictures, Haiwong Wan, and our instruction coordinator at the back, Brian Carson. Daniel Peach and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Terry Perkins. Our speaker tonight is a native of Dayton, Ohio, where her family was excited about outer space since her dad worked for the Air Force's space program. She grew up in Dayton and Columbus, Ohio, before her family moved to Raleigh, North Carolina, to raise three teenage girls. As a child, she wanted to be an author or a waitress, and was influenced by her second grade teacher, Mrs. Capstick, to forget the waitress part and to consider the author part. She attended Principia College in Elsa, Illinois, before moving to the University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa, where she received an MA in journalism and a PhD in mass communications. She joined the journalism faculty at Samford University in Birmingham in 1994 and teaches classes in media history. In 2010, her book, Wings of Opportunity, The Wright Brothers in Montgomery, Alabama, was published by New South Books, and it described how Montgomery civic leaders lured Orville and Wilbur Wright to set up America's first civilian school to train pilots. Her current research interests include the Colonial Press and Laura Ingalls Wilder's sister Carrie, who is a frontier journalist. Her interest in tonight's topic grew out of tales told by her great uncle, Albert Caldwell, who with his family survived the sinking of the Titanic. It culminated in her newest book, A Rare Titanic Family, The Caldwell Story of Survival, published this year by New South Books and recommended by the New York Times. Please give a warm welcome to Julie Williams. Julie?
Thank you, Brian. Listen, children, to a story that was written long ago. I wonder if you know that song. If so, you probably are my age. All right, I'm going to ask in a minute if anybody remembers what that old song is about. And I'll tell you right away, it was not about the Titanic. But to me, that's what it was about. Because when that song was popular, we moved to Raleigh, as Brian has just told you. And suddenly, I was geographically near my great-uncle, Albert Caldwell, who lived in Richmond, and who had survived the Titanic back in 1912. And suddenly, I got to hear that story all the time. Now, I had known my great-uncle all my life. That's actually me and the tulips. It was really cute then. And that's my great-uncle with me. And as you can see, he always looked 125, but he always acted 25. So I know him all my life, but it was only when that song became popular that I really got to know the story. So who is remember what that old song is about? Yes?
About a fight for some rights on a kingdom.
Fight for some rights on a kingdom. What were they fighting over? She's good. She got it first try.
Treasures.
Treasures. Give this lady a hand. All right. They were fighting over a buried treasure. Well, this was a very popular song, and I would go around the house singing it. And to my eternal shock, kids, your parents really do listen to the lyrics of those songs. This was a surprise to me. So my mother would say, oh, buried treasure. We have a buried treasure in our family. And we did. Ours was on the Titanic at the bottom of the Atlantic. And it consisted of gold coins, American gold pieces, that my great-uncle and his wife were bringing back from Siam, we would say Thailand, today. Well, Uncle Al always told me, honey, when they find the Titanic, you can have my gold pieces. I am still waiting to get those gold pieces. I doubt I'll ever see a nickel of the gold pieces, but I did get a wonderful golden treasure from the Titanic, which is a story my great-uncle told me of how he, his wife Sylvia, and their infant son Alden, all three survived the Titanic, one of the few families to survive intact, making them a rare Titanic family. And this is the story as he told it to me. Albert and Sylvia met as college students at Park College in Parkville, Missouri. There's my great uncle with hair, I never knew him with hair. He was always bald when I knew him, but I think he was very handsome. And there's his lovely wife, Sylvia. There we go. They got married on September 1st, 1909, and left that very day to go to Bangkok to become missionaries. They didn't even have a honeymoon, and I just know that's why they got divorced later. Here's where they were going, Bangkok Christian College, which was neither Christian nor college. All the boys in the school were Buddhists. Okay, now the way the Christian part came in was the staff was Presbyterian missionaries. And it wasn't a college. It was what we would call a K-12 school, toddlers to teenagers. But it was called a college because large schools in the Orient in that era were always called colleges. This was considered a very large school because it had 180 students. Today, Bangkok Christian College is still there. Here's how it looks today. And today it actually has 5,000 students and is the oldest school in Thailand, which is kind of neat. Well, while the Caldwells were in Siam, their first son, Alden, was born. And I love this googly-eyed photo of my great-uncle making a face at his newborn baby. On the back, he has written, speaking for Alden, "For the land of love, is this my dad? He looks like a circus clown." But I love looking at all photographs to see what you can tell. Look at this one. Notice Albert's boots. If you can see them, they've got mud all over the heels. You could tell, therefore, there are no paved streets in Bangkok in that era. Notice he's wearing a white, lightweight linen suit. Notice also that his chair is designed for air to flow through. And look at the wall behind him. It's louvered. All right, if you can't have guessed by now, it's very hot in Bangkok. You could get the clues there, but you can also look it up on modern web pages. One of them says there are three seasons in Thailand: the hot season, the hot and rainy season, and the hottest you've ever been in your life season. In fact, I put that on my Facebook page, and someone who works at Bangkok Christian College gave me a like. Well, one person who found it to be the hottest she'd ever been in her life was poor Sylvia, who was pregnant during the hottest you've ever been in your life season. Oh, I see a lot of the ladies wincing who were probably pregnant this summer. Anyway, it was miserable. She had a hard pregnancy. The baby was successfully born, but she was still suffering after she gave birth, and the Caldwells decided the only answer was for them to go home. So they took their savings, which had been paid in Siamese teacups, took them down to the Bank Dalindo Sheen and said, "We need these teacups turned into dollars because we're going home." The bank said they could do that for a 20% penalty. Ooh, that was too much. So Albert said, "No, never mind, I have a better idea." So he took the teacups down to the dock in Bangkok and waited for any American sailor to get off of any American ship, because he knew the sailors always came with dollars, but if they wanted to carouse, they had to have teacups. It didn't take him long before he found a sailor who was willing to trade money with him, and that sailor paid him $100 in American gold coins. Now, these look very exotic and strange to us today, but they were legal tender at the time, so they didn't look odd to Uncle Al. And today, they constitute our treasure at the bottom of the Atlantic because they never made it home. Okay, now don't blink, because you're going to see the Caldwells make a very fast trip through the Indian Ocean. Okay, they got on a ship called the Derflinger, and away they went. All right, my own son, Alden, taught me how to do that. He's very proud of his old mom for figuring that out. That looks so fast. It took, what, 3 seconds on screen? In reality, it took them a month to go through the Indian Ocean. A long, grueling month. So the Caldwells are really thrilled to see Naples, Italy. And that's how it looked when they arrived. And on the day they arrived, there was a ship in the harbor flying the American flag, which they knew meant it was leaving for the United States that day. And Albert turned to a sailor on the Derflinger and he said, "What ship is that?" And the sailor said, "Well, that's the Carpathia leaving for the United States today." Well, according to my memory, Albert got on the Carpathia and scoped it out with the thought of taking it home. According to my sister's memory, he stood in line to buy tickets to the Carpathia, but he changed his mind. According to my mother, his niece, he definitely considered taking the Carpathia, but for some reason they went into Naples instead and got a hotel room. And there the Caldwells saw an advertisement that marked them for life. It was an ad for the Titanic, the world's largest and newest ship. It was leaving on a maiden voyage pretty soon. And, largest ship on the ocean, and about the time they thought they would leave Europe, it was also leaving. And so Albert turned to Sylvia and he said, "There, that's the ship we're taking." So to get to that ship, they went through Europe. They saw Rome and They saw Florence, and they saw my favorite, Venice. They went to Lake Lucerne, and then they wound up in Paris. Well, by the time they got to Paris, they had figured out that their light white linen clothes from Siam were not going to cut it anymore. It was actually cold in Europe. They had to have clothes that were actually for cold weather. So they bought all new clothes in Paris. If you're going to get new clothes, it might as well be Paris, right? They were going to go home to the tiny little crossroads of Bixville, Illinois, in complete style. And they went to London. One of the most important things they did in London was to go to the offices of the White Star Line to get a cabin, a ticket to that Titanic, that ship they had seen advertised. Albert went in and said, "We'd like a cabin there, second class," and the clerk said, "Sorry, sold out." Ah, Uncle Al was so crestfallen, it had never occurred to him that the Titanic might be sold out. And he always said, "I must have looked like a disappointed boy," because the clerk said, "Sir, every day there's a cancellation. If you come in tomorrow, you can have the first cancellation that comes in." So I got up early the next day and went in nervous and sweating, hoping to get a canceled ticket on the Titanic. He waited half the day before a cancellation finally came in, and it was even in second class, exactly what they had wanted. The Caldwells were the luckiest people in the world. They were going home on the Titanic. So on the day baby Alden turned 10 months old, they got on the boat train to go from London to the port of London, which is Southampton. Everybody on the train was going to the Titanic. And they were talking about how lucky they were to be on the world's largest, most luxurious, most opulent ship and unsinkable. Everyone was talking about that. Well, one person who was skeptical about it being unsinkable was Sylvia. So she asked the luggage handler who was taking their travel trunk into their cabin, "Is this ship really unsinkable?" And he answered with a notoriously erroneous reply, probably the most famous line ever spoken about the Titanic. Who can tell me what it is? Go for it.
"Madam, God himself cannot sink this ship."
She got to give her applause too. Over time. He said to her, "Yes, lady," or "Madam, God himself could not sink this ship." Now that line is stolen in every movie about the Titanic, many novels about it, and rarely is Sylvia given any credit. But now you know. We know this line from Sylvia Caldwell. Well, it was an absolutely beautiful voyage. The music on the Titanic was terrific. The Caldwells are both very musical people. They both played instruments. They sang in glee clubs. They had formed a glee club in Bangkok. So they were just charmed with the Titanic because the band on the Titanic played outside the second class library. They could hear music whenever they wanted. Notice, second class had its own library. They could check out a book whenever they wanted. Oh, and the food was just terrific. As Albert said, the tables were piled high with all the delicacies one could ever want. Just delicious. And even better, no one was seasick. So if you enjoyed those delicacies, you didn't have to worry about feeling nauseous later. Oh, the Titanic was so smooth. It was knifing through the water. None of the pitching and rolling you got with other ships. And, so fast. You remember that quick trip to the Indian Ocean that I showed you a minute ago? That really took a month? Well, the Titanic was set to cross the Atlantic in less than a week, so it seemed like flying to them. Well, one thing Albert loved to do was to take photographs around this great ship, as he called it. He had a camera, he loved using it. But one day while Sylvia and Alden were having a nap, he decided he would take pictures in the engine room. Now, the trick is you can't just go into the engine room of a ship without permission. You have to get somebody to take you down there. Well, that wasn't hard for Uncle Al. He never met a stranger. He could talk anybody into anything. And just a few minutes later, he was down in the engine room with a member of the crew, and he took pictures of the great engines just as he had thought. But then he saw the stokers, like this man pictured here, shoveling coal into the Titanic's furnaces. And he recognized that these men were the true power behind the Titanic because they shoveled the coal in, the coal and the fire generated the steam, and it was a steamship, and that was what was making the ship fly across the Atlantic. And he thought, "I'm going to take their picture." Then he thought, "No, wait, I'm going to shovel the coal and they're going to take my picture." And don't we love to do that on vacation? Anyway, that was what his plan was. So he asked the stokers, "Would you mind doing this?" Well, they loved it. They didn't see many passengers. They were kind of segregated from them, so he egged them on and said, "Sure." One of them gave him his shovel and told him how to hold it, and Albert gave him the camera and told him how to use it. They exchanged names. That became important later. And the man took his picture. Little did they know that shovel full of coal and that photograph would save his life. Well, on April 14, 1912, it was a Sunday, so of course, our good Presbyterian missionaries went to the church service that was held in the second-class dining room. and they sang a lot of hymns that night, but chiefly this one, the old naval hymn, Eternal Father, strong to save. Who's in the Navy? Could sing the rest. Ah, nobody answered. Anyway, famous naval hymn, and it's actually a prayer for people who are in danger on the sea. And it ends with this line at the bottom, for those in peril on the sea. And that was the line the pastor picked up to make his sermon. He talked about the perils of life and compared them to the perils of the sea. Now everyone listening understood it was a symbolic sermon. It did not apply to them. They were on the unsinkable ship. They were not in any peril. And Albert would always say, we were so happy to be worshiping God that night. Little did we know how many of us would meet God that night. Well, it was a really cold evening. Normally they took Alden out for a spin on deck. Not tonight, too cold. They got into their bunks to stay warm. Albert loved his bed on the Titanic. It was one of his two favorite things on the ship. His first favorite thing was electric elevators that went between the decks. It was such a novelty to see an electric elevator that people lined up to take the elevator, whether they needed to go to another deck or not. But otherwise, he loved his bed. He loved it because it vibrated with the movement of the ship, and it was so comfortable. You know, it was soft, it was brand new, no one had ever used it before. No one would ever use it again, but it also had no lumps. It was great, and he loved that vibrating bed. He said it was a great way to sleep. However, one person who was not sleeping so well was Sylvia. She was sharing her bed with baby Alden. I frankly don't know how she got any sleep. So in the middle of the night, she felt the ship shudder. She felt the ship hit the iceberg. And she tried to wake her husband up, but she didn't try too hard. It was kind of like, honey, something's wrong, wake up. Well, she didn't want to yell too loud because earlier that day, little Alden had been screaming his head off, as babies will do. And as young parents will do, the Caldwells were frantic. They thought he would bother the people in the next cabin, so they tried everything. They tried rocking him and singing to him and playing with him, and nothing worked until finally they got their keys. They held him up, jingle, jingle, off. Thank goodness that's what the baby wanted, so they gave Alden their keys. Well, she didn't want to go through that again here at midnight, so she wasn't trying too hard to wake up her husband. Now, he never thought he heard her, but he must have heard her subconsciously because suddenly he sat bolt upright in bed, wide awake, and he knew right away the ship had stopped. Why? Because now his bed was a dead calm. So he leaped out of bed, threw on a raincoat, ran out on deck, and saw a sailor looking over the side of the ship. And he said, why have we stopped? And the sailor said, just ran into a little iceberg. No harm done, I guess. Go back to bed. So Albert did. He said it was really hard to get back to sleep without the bed going vibrating. But just as he was drifting off, he was shocked awake by someone pounding on the door and yelling, everybody on deck with your life belts. The Caldwells were so discouraged. Here was Alden asleep at last, and the last thing they wanted to do was to wake up a sleeping baby and have him screaming again there at midnight. So they dressed very, very slowly, hoping somebody would come back and say, never mind, it was all a mistake. But finally, they left those brand new Parisian fashions in their cabin, which is where they still are, wore their oldest clothes, then they had to wake the baby and get him dressed. He had a little coat and a little hat, which were in the trunk, and they went to get that coat and hat, and that's when they realized that he had lost the keys to the trunk earlier that day when he had been playing with them. They looked and looked and looked for those keys and never could find them. Alden, being 10 months old, wasn't telling where he'd put them. So they finally had to wrap baby all in a blanket, leaving their gold pieces and Sylvia's jewelry all in that trunk. And they went out on deck. Now, other than being midnight and extremely cold, it was kind of pleasant. There was no panic. There was no real concern. Everyone was milling about, talking, making the best of this strange situation. They were all making small talk and just having a general pleasant conversation. They could all see a ship on the horizon with its lights burning. And as Albert said, to the worst, she'll come and save us. However, they knew there was no worse because the Titanic was one big lifeboat. It couldn't go down. But then they were shocked. Shocked because the sailors started breaking out the lifeboats and ordering women and children to get on. Women and children were not interested. The few who got on were forced on by husbands or by crew. Now the Caldwells had a decision to make. Should Sylvia and Alden get on that lifeboat? Well, Albert tested it. He thought, well, the ship is taking on water. It will be listing. So he tested the deck, but it was perfectly flat. No list to that deck. He listened for the sound of water, the inrush of water. There was none. He looked around for panic. There was none. He even went back to the cabin to get another blanket from little Alden. Now I know he looked for that key again. Couldn't find it. He wound up just getting another blanket and coming back. and in the going to and from to the cabin, he stepped through a watertight door that was still open. Now, everyone knew that the Titanic stayed afloat by means of watertight doors. The captain could push a button and watertight doors would drop, and that would keep out the ocean in the event of an accident. Clearly, here was a watertight door that was still open because obviously the captain didn't think it was dangerous. At least that was Uncle Al's interpretation. Now, we don't know if he really saw a watertight door or not, but that was what he thought it was, and this just reinforced to him that there was no danger. Whatever he saw, you know, was open. Well, he and Sylvie decided that this was just the rule of the sea. The rule book said if you had an accident, you better break out the lifeboats. It's just that was procedure. And they thought there was no reason for them to put Sylvie and Alden on that lifeboat. So they were milling about, waiting for the all clear to go back to their cabin, when suddenly a group of stokers appeared on the deck where the Caldwells were waiting. One of them recognized Albert from the day of the photograph and called him by name, Mr. Caldwell, locked eyes with him and said, if you value your life, get off this ship. I've been below and the hold is filling up with water and this ship will go down. Well, now this sounded very dire. He could picture the hold because he had seen it on his tour. And he thought, well, that, you know, they should know they were down there. But he still argued with the stokers. He said, everyone knows the Titanic is one big lifeboat. At this point, another stoker intervened and said, well, let's say you get off the Titanic now, and she's still here in the morning, you can get back on. Well, that kind of made sense to him. At just that moment, Lifeboat 13 was passing by their deck. The stokers stopped it, they all got on, and the Caldwells followed. Albert always credited divine intervention at this point because he later found out that his father, who was a Presbyterian minister back in Biggsville, that night had gotten down on his knees and prayed for the safe return of his family. Well, for a while, it looked like Lifeboat 13 was going to be the harrowing experience of the night. Because the lifeboat was supposed to go down smoothly on the side of the ship like that, but the pulleys didn't work. Oh, that lifeboat jerked down and back, and oh, they were hanging off for dear life. It was just an awful ride down. When they finally hit the water line, they were in front of a pump that was throwing water out of the ship. They all got drenched. Sylvia said it was a miracle they didn't so much as catch cold. Now, the action of that water and their own action to avoid it, it pushed them backwards to where they were underneath Lifeboat 15 coming down. The people on 13 went to pull a lever that would release them from the side of the Titanic, and it was gummed up with shiny red paint. Now, when I was about 12 years old, I remember Uncle Al telling me that, and I was so chagrined because I did not realize the Titanic was in color. In my day, there were no color photographs, there was no color movie, it was all in black and white. So I remember being very embarrassed to learn the Titanic had deep red trim and was very colorful. Anyway, this red paint had pulled the mechanism and they could not get free. They started yelling, stop blowing that boat, stop, we're stuck under here. But no one could hear them over the outflow of that pump. Here came 15 closer and closer, threatening to crush them, smack them all into the water, something horrible. And they were screaming and yelling, but it finally took 15 getting so close that they could knock on the bottom until 15 got the message and was able to yell up, stop lowering. At that point, Sylvie recalled that someone on 15 threw a knife down to them. Albert recalled that one of the stokers had a knife in his pocket. In any case, two of the crew cut them free. And at last, 13 could row away. They rowed a half a mile away, as they'd been directed. And there, for the first time, Albert realized the Titanic really was going to sink. He had not perceived or believed the Titanic was in any danger until he got that far away and he could see that it was goner. And he was just horrified. So they had the sad task of watching the great ship go down. He said that the lights burned until the very end, in fact, burning it from underneath the water as the bow was pulled under. Finally, the lights winked out and there was a terrible explosion and the bow broke off and sunk on its own. That left just the stern, very dark against a very cheerful starlit sky. And slowly it filled with water, and then, as he would put it, with a gentle swish, she was gone. There was a moment of stunned silence, and then the cries started. Everyone on the Titanic, except tiny babies like Alden, was issued a life jacket. Most were wearing them and had been thrown into the water. They could have been saved had it been warm tropical waters, but unfortunately the water was 28 degrees. It was below normal freezing due to the salt content, and people very quickly were perishing of hypothermia. And they were calling for help, help that they wouldn't get. Sylvia said it was the weirdest, most appalling, heart-rending noise ever mortal might hear. One man on their lifeboat was in denial. He said, oh, but it's just people singing. As Sylvia said, however, but who could be deceived? She knew what it was. Now, I don't remember Uncle Al ever speaking about this time. Finally, when he was 90 years old, I thought to ask him, Uncle Al, what about the people in the water? Now, he always had a big smile on his face. He was just the representation of joy. But this one time, that smile went away, and his face turned completely gray. And he said, you just have to forget the screams, or you'd go crazy. Now, for a while, their lot seemed nearly as dire. True, they were in a lifeboat. But they knew that for millennia, people had gone to the sea in ships, and if they got off on a lifeboat, they would only drift until they perished themselves. They knew the Titanic had the newest in technology called the Marconi, i.e. the radio, and they knew the Titanic had tried to call for help, but it hadn't worked. It hadn't brought that ship on the horizon. They didn't know how it worked or if it could work. It's kind of like when my son brought me a sort of iPod-looking thing the other day and said, look at this great thing, and I'm like, how does it work? How do you even turn it on? I couldn't even find the on-off switch. It was that horrible feeling of not understanding the technology and their lives depended on it. They also knew the Atlantic was normally very rough and very choppy. This one night it was still as a mill pond, but how long would that last? They only had 6 inches clearance between the edge of the boat and the water. They knew the first wave was going to put them in the water and they knew what would happen. Now, ironically, it was the iceberg that was blocking the waves that night. While they were scanning the horizon, anxiously looking for the sign of a rescue ship, they would see lights on other lifeboats, but they were fooled by them. Finally, after an hour, someone on their boat said, I see a light and I know it's from a ship. They didn't believe it, didn't dare believe, but finally after 2 hours, they all could see it was a ship coming. And they were cheering Mr. Marconi for inventing the Marconi. Then they realized they didn't have a light on their lifeboat. How would that ship ever see them there in the dark, so low down? It would run over them and smash them. They got frantic. Finally, they decided they would burn their coats on that horribly cold night. At that point, somebody on the lifeboat realized or admitted she had letters she had written to her daughters, and she volunteered to sacrifice them. She twisted them to a torch, and they lit them one by one by one by one so that the rescue ship could see them. When dawn broke, the rescue ship was standing a safe distance off. Albert looked up, and he was startled to recognize it. It was the Carpathia, the very ship he had turned down in Naples exactly 1 month later. And so he was very glad now to be on the passenger list of the Carpathia. And by the way, she was on her way back to Naples, but she turned around and took him back to New York. Both Albert and Sylvia said the saddest thing was watching the women of the Titanic line the rails of the Carpathia as each lifeboat pulled up, looking for a husband, a son, a brother, or a sweetheart who never came. They realized right away they were one of the few families to have survived intact, and they were completely shocked. They did not know that this was the case. Well, that was a story, as Albert told it to me, a story that was true and accurate, and yet I hardly knew the story at all. We began to realize we didn't know the story when Albert passed away in 1977. He was 91 years old. And among his paper goods that came to my mother was this photograph. There it is. It was of a young family on the deck of a very large ship. It wasn't labeled. We could tell it was a large ship due to the size of the cable behind a man's head. Well, we thought, could this be them on the Titanic? Yes, we couldn't even recognize the people because the adults' faces were in the shadow. It was a terrible picture. It even had a hole in it. But for some reason, he had saved it all these years. So we sat to doing research. Our entire family, we looked at a bunch of different factors, such as the weather on sailing day. If this were taken on the Titanic, did the weather match? Indeed, it was cloudy and yucky that day. If this were the Titanic, could we recognize the two ships you see in the background over their shoulders? Indeed, we could. They were the St. Louis and the Philadelphia, parked next to the Titanic. Were they wearing fashions from 1912? Some fashion research indicated indeed they were. And we looked at a bunch of other factors, but by the time 2 weeks had gone by, we not only knew for sure it was the Caldwells on the Titanic, but we knew exactly where they were standing on the Titanic. And by the way, this has been authenticated many times over by other Titanic experts, and caused a great sensation this year when it came out of my book. Well, one person we took it to authenticate, it was my great-aunt Jenny, Albert's second wife. You all recall that Sylvia and Albert divorced. They divorced in 1930, and in 1936, Albert married my Aunt Jenny, which is how I came to be my great-uncle. And at the time, Aunt Jenny was living in a nursing home. She was perfectly sharp of mind, but she needed some physical care. And we thought she might like some photographs to brighten up her room, so we took her a stack of family photographs and flipped them over. And then without warning her, I flipped over the Titanic picture, and I said, Aunt Jenny, what's that? And she said, oh, there's Albert on the Titanic. I forgot we had that old thing. If you can imagine, all the 40 years Aunt Jenny was married to my Uncle Al, she got to hear over and over and over again about his adventures with his first wife. So it was a family joke that Aunt Jenny was really tired of hearing about the Titanic. Well, I said, Aunt Jenny, how did he get the picture? We knew the camera went down with the ship. And she said, oh, some friend of theirs in London took it and sent it to them later. Well, that was all we knew, and that was all I thought we'd ever know. Aunt Jenny was a great artist. She loved to paint, and this is my favorite of all her paintings. She painted this picture evocative of the Titanic leaving port, and at the bottom she wrote her own commentary on the Titanic. It says, "Should all acquaintance be forgot?" Aunt Jenny's opinion of the Titanic. She was really funny. Then there was the mystery of the Carpathia. Why, if they had planned this great trip through Europe, why did they consider taking the Carpathia home from Naples? It didn't quite make sense, but we had never thought to ask. Would we ever know? And then those rumors that my sisters and I heard all the years we were growing up. They were kind of hush-hush, you know. Sylvia was really sick. The rumor was Sylvia wasn't really sick when they left Siam. She just wanted to go home, so she faked an illness. Well, the older I got, the more I realized that whenever we had a question about the Titanic era, we'd blame Sylvia. Because she was the first wife, and we were the family of the second wife, and that was just too convenient. And I also realized it was unfair to Sylvia, so I had to find out, was she really sick? I love this picture of them leaving Siam. By the way, you can see Sylvia has a Spider-Man outfit. So I'm trying to dress as Sylvia. She was a lot younger and cuter than I am, but hey, you know, I try. And then there was the mystery that rose up from the depths after all three of the Caldwells had lived to ripe old ages and died of natural causes, not of shipwreck. At that point, someone put a watch up for auction at Christie's Auction House in London, saying it was the watch the Caldwells used to bribe their way off the Titanic. Well, we were shocked because Uncle Al had spoken about the Titanic from 1912 to 1976 with his head held high and a smile on his face. He didn't seem to be guilty or embarrassed or hiding anything, but I had to find out. Well, interestingly, every single one of those questions ultimately touched in some fashion on whether Sylvia was really sick or not, and I decided the way to find out if she was really sick would be to read her file in the Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia. So I informed my husband, guess what, we're going to Philadelphia on our vacation. Good man that he is, he said, okay, and we packed our children into the car and drove to Philadelphia. Well, while the boys all toured a battleship one day, I went to the Historical Society and I read the Caldwell's files. And I learned so much about their youth and their college days and their application to be missionaries and their professors' sometimes unhappy opinions of them and their early years in the mission. And then I got to the part where they resigned. And it said, resigned. And that was all it said. Okay, so we had fun in Philadelphia anyway, and I came home and started ordering microfilms of the secretary's minutes, hoping the secretary had mentioned their resignation. Finally, after several rolls of microfilm, I came across it, the handwritten diagnosis by Sylvia's doctor saying she had neurasthenia. All right, does anyone know what neurasthenia is? Has anybody had it? She knows what neurasthenia is, and she's read the book, am I right?
No, I have it. Fibromyalgia.
Well, people do liken it today to fibromyalgia, and that's very good. Actually, the reason nobody in general has used the term neurasthenia for years is because it was actually declared no longer useful as a diagnosis in 1932. The American Medical Association quit using that word. Now, the reason was that it had been popularly diagnosed from 1865 to 1932, and indeed, people that had the disease did have physical symptoms such as an arm or leg that didn't work, or shortness of breath, or blurred vision, or bent double. Now notice that's a lot of symptoms that aren't necessarily related. Some of them had mental symptoms, such as depression or lingering malaise. And you're beginning to see that the description of neurasthenia was really out of hand. A lot of different symptoms that were completely unrelated. Ultimately, by 1932, about everybody in the planet had been told they had it, and everybody had different symptoms. So that year, the American Medical Association said, okay, it's over. We will never diagnose this disease again. Now, to be fair to Sylvia and those who had it for those years, it was taken seriously. And indeed, they say today, diseases like fibromyalgia, mononucleosis, post-traumatic stress disorder, postpartum depression, all of those things might have been called neurasthenia. But as it goes, neurasthenia was ruled out of the lexicon in 1932, so that in 1933, if you said you had neurasthenia, people considered you a hypochondriac. Well, I began to see where that rumor in our family got started because Uncle Al came into our family about 1934 when he met Aunt Jenny. And I could just hear him saying, my first wife had neurasthenia, and she's thinking, oh yeah, that's a hypochondriac's disease. And I believe I began to see the beginning of that rumor. Now, in this diagnosis, the doctor said Sylvia, if she stayed in Siam, would lose her mind, the same as Mrs. Barrett. Well, who was Mrs. Barrett? There was another research project. And I ultimately found Mrs. Barrett in a book of the year of missions, about the missionary work in 1908. And this was a book designed for the public, it was on the public library shelves, and the attempt of it was to get people interested in becoming missionaries, or to donate. So you can imagine that anything bad was cleaned up and made more, you know, palatable, more pretty. So with that in mind, I read the passage on Mrs. Barrett, and it said that she was another missionary in Siam who had gone stark raving mad in the tropical heat, and she had to be carried away by native boats. Okay, that was like totally creepy, and I knew that it had to probably be a very sanitized story. And it was very clear the Caldwells knew all about Mrs. Barrett because the record was full of pitiful letters from my great uncle begging that Sylvia be allowed to go home so that she didn't become like Mrs. Barrett. Well, why did they have to beg to go home? You know, couldn't they just turn in their 2-week notice like we would do today? No. They were expecting to stay in Siam for life. It was a lifetime appointment. Oh yeah, that was hard, wasn't it? And the way it actually worked was you had a 7-year hitch, then you had a year of furlough. You could go home, do whatever you wanted, then you came back and had periodic furloughs for the rest of your career. Now, it was well known that many missionaries washed out on their furlough and didn't come back, but the truth was the Caldwells were not even close to their furlough. They were only 2 years into their 7-year hitch. And so they had to ask to go home. But wait a minute, why did they just go? Why did they have to have permission? Well, part of their pay was their trip home. And you can imagine what an expensive trip that was pretty much around the world. Today, if we wanted to leave Bangkok in a hurry, we could go to the airport and buy an airplane ticket for $2,000 and be home in about 24 hours. We'd have to pay off our credit card. Nobody likes to have a $2,000 charge, but we could do it, probably. Not so easy in 1912. Ultimately, it took the Caldwells 4 ships, multiple hotels, multiple railroads, and 2 solid months of travel to get home. So you can see they really needed the church to pay their way to go home. Anyway, so they begged to go home, they put it to a vote, and as you see by the slide, they were turned down. Now they knew they were in trouble because the same thing had happened to their friends, the Connie Bears, who we'll talk about in a minute. Interestingly, the fact that her case, Sylvia's case, was compared to Mrs. Barrett was so denounced in the mission that the doctor actually lost his job. He resigned over this. It was a big deal. And the doctor did prescribe for her to go to Naples to take the rest cure. Now let me know whether they're going to Naples. And interestingly, he said she should go to Naples because it was a cooler climate. You know, we go to sunny Italy for the sun, but if you're from Siam, you're going there because it's cool. I mentioned the Connie Bears. Here they are, Sam and Bess Connie Bear, the best friends of the Caldwells. They met in the mission for the first time. Instantly became friends, similar ages, both newlyweds. And they, some months before the Caldwells, decided they needed to come home too. Now, their reason, the official reason, was that Sam was given a transfer to a very small post, an outpost in Bangkok, that he didn't want. He was supposed to be an ordained minister in that post, and he wasn't an ordained minister. He said, I'm not qualified. And the boss said, well, you have to go anyway. He said, but I'm not a minister. And the boss said, too bad. So they got into an argument and were stalling. Well, the unofficial reason is their daughter is still living in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and their daughter believes that Bess had a miscarriage, and they were hoping to go home because they thought they might have more success giving birth there. But in either case, they were at loggerheads with the boss, and they begged to go home, and they kept getting turned down. Bess's diary is still, we still have it, and she cried every day. It was so sad to read it. Finally, after some weeks of begging, the Connie Bears had an epiphany. They realized they had enough money to go home on their own. Now, this was unheard of because it was so expensive. I theorize that somebody from home cabled them some money, and their daughter thinks that's what happened. She's trying to prove it right now, but we hope we find that out. But here's the Caldwells on the right and the Connie Bears on the left playing dominoes. Well, anyway, they suddenly found they had enough money to go home, so the Connie Bears marched into that mean old boss and said, guess what, we're out of here. The boss was just shocked because nobody could normally do this, so he made them sign a legal document saying they knew they wouldn't get paid. This made Bess cry again. Well, as a parting blow, Sam decided to mouth off to his boss, which we know is not a good idea, but you can see why he was upset. And he said to the boss, you know, we're not the only unhappy missionaries. Others are saving their money to go home too. Now, he never mentioned a name, but the boss, in writing this up for headquarters back in New York, said, evidently, he's talking about the Caldwells. So from that moment until 5 months later, when Sylvia got her diagnosis, the boss was waiting for them to ask to go home, and he was already prepared to say no. So the Caldwells are pretty much doomed. And you know, the charge was that they were saving their money to go home, which sounds strange to us because we treasure the idea of saving money. But to the boss, it meant they were going to renege on their contract. He thought that was a bad sign. And you know, it wasn't without merit. They were saving their money. Remember the tea kettles? It turned into gold? Well, they freely admitted that was their money they saved from their salary. It was only $100, but that was actually about $2,200 today, which is enough to buy their ticket across the Atlantic. So they really needed the okay of the mission to get the rest of the way. And ultimately, they grudgingly got permission to go home. Now, another question was Naples. Now we knew they had been ordered there to take the rest cure. Why did they go through Europe instead? Why did they consider taking the Carpathia? Didn't know. Well, by dumb luck, I came across a book in the library called Naples in the Time of Cholera. And sure enough, there was cholera when they arrived in Naples. Now they knew they could not stay in Naples. Too dangerous. So they quickly searched around for any answer to that question, and they saw the Carpathia there, ready to leave. And they thought about taking it. Well, why didn't they? Luckily, at this point, their grandson stepped in with a memory. He commented that his grandmother was a very seasick person and had been seasick a lot. And oh boy, was that borne out in the record. She wrote to her college alumni magazine saying, "I was sick every day on the Indian Ocean." Okay, how many of you have written to your college alumni magazine about being seasick? No, nobody ever does. People write about their children or their dogs or their grandchildren or their job. Nobody writes about seasickness. And the fact that that was so unusual makes you think that was a really bad case of seasickness. So we know she was seasick every day. And apparently, according to her grandson's memory, they pulled into the harbor, frantically thought of taking the Carpathia, and she said, "No, it's too small. I'll be seasick." Well, I had this dawning moment. I thought, wait a minute, I wonder how the Derfflinger and the Carpathia compared in size. The Derfflinger was the ship she was sick on. And I looked them up, and they were identical in size. So Sylvia apparently said, "No, small ships, too much rocking and pitching. I want a big ship." So with the magic of PowerPoint, we can park the Titanic next to the Carpathia, and you can see that it is a much bigger ship. And you know, it worked. She wasn't seasick. Had not been for the little matter of hitting the iceberg. Well, so as the Caldwells headed home, having bypassed Naples, they were maybe unaware that they were still under surveillance by their mean old boss back in Siam. What happened was they spent 5 more months in Siam before they left so that Albert could finish the school year. It was the cool season in Siam, and the doctor gave Sylvia his blessing to stay 5 more months. They thought that would put them in good stead with their boss, but instead their boss decided that, well, Sylvia wasn't really sick. Maybe another source of that rumor. I believe he thought that she had just been naive about pregnancy. She clearly had a hard pregnancy. Bess's diary proves that. And he thought she was just naive, thinking that that would be the end of her life, and it was just a hard pregnancy. And that she should not have been allowed to go home. But he could not call her back, and he thought of a way to get around that. He wrote ahead to New York, to headquarters, and he said, "The Caldwells are on their way home. When they arrive in New York, have Mrs. Caldwell examined by some of our doctors before you settle their account." Well, I gasped when I read that, because for years I had known that when Sylvia arrived in New York, that there was a private ambulance waiting to take her directly to Presbyterian Hospital. It was even staffed by a minister. Now, they weren't interested in taking her husband, or especially not her baby, if you think they might have been worried about an infant, but no. They were waiting to take Sylvia directly to Presbyterian Hospital, and according to the boss's letter, if she were found healthy, they would owe the money for that trip around the world. Well, all these years I had thought that ambulance was a mission of mercy. Apparently, for all those years, I was wrong. Or did the Caldwells know about the ambulance? Because, well, Sylvia gave it the slip. She did not go with the ambulance. She did not even meet the driver. She managed to be spirited away to a hotel. Now, was she tipped off? I actually believe she was. I believe someone on the Foreign Missions Board was sympathetic and made sure she did not go to that examination. If you want to find out how that happened, you'll have to read the book. But what about that bribe? Did the Caldwells really bribe their way off the Titanic? I really gave this an honest look as a historian, not as somebody fond of my uncle, and I think it really is not true. Why? Well, we know that Sylvia was seasick, but over time, I also figured out that she obviously could not hold little Alden, whatever neurasthenia meant to her, and we don't know because the word has no more meaning. But at the time, it meant something, and I believe she had something wrong, like an arm or a leg that didn't work. It was visible to the naked eye, because every single account of them getting on the lifeboat goes like this. A mama and a daddy and a baby came to the lifeboat with the daddy holding the baby. Everyone remembered that because it was unusual. The mama got in the lifeboat, and the daddy went to hand her the baby, and the officer said, "Sir, is that your wife?" And Albert said, "Yes." And the officer said, "Get in the boat and hold the baby." So according to every account, Albert was invited into the lifeboat to hold the baby. And indeed, one of the great myths of the Titanic was that men were not allowed on the ship. But the Titanic was divided in two halves, this one and this one. On this half, the officer in charge was not letting men off, just refused to let them off. On this half, the officer in charge was letting men off, and this was the half my great uncle was on. And so there were already men in the lifeboat. So it seems as though, by all accounts, there was no reason for him to have been denied entry into the lifeboat, and that he was invited on. In fact, the two photographs we have of them in that era tend to bear this out. Notice in both of those pictures, who's holding the baby? It's Dad. And there was a Scottish factor in all this. The watch that was the bribe was engraved to James Caldwell of the Pumpherston Oil Company. According to Christie's Auction House, James and Albert were relatives. Here's where James lived, in Pumpherston, Scotland, 600 miles from London. And according to Christie's, he came down and visited Albert at his home at 2 Upper Montague Street, London. Well, Albert never lived at 2 Upper Montague Street, London. Albert lived in Bangkok. Where did that come from? So after much research, I discovered that that was the address Albert gave when he was trying to get that canceled ticket. Well, after much more research, I discovered that indeed it was a hotel in London. It was called the Bansha. And when the Caldwells had to give an address at the White Star Line, that was the address they gave because they wanted them to call them with that ticket cancellation. Well, the Bansha advertised that they had a good table, meaning everybody ate together. It had electric lights and it had billiards, so they probably played in a little pool. Well, now we know they were at the Bansha at 2 Upper Montague Street for about a week. Okay, so now according to Christie's, James Caldwell, who was supposedly a relative, came down on the train sometime during that week and gave Albert a watch that he took on the Titanic. Luckily, we know what James Caldwell was doing that week, because he ran a coal mine for Pumpherston Oil, and during that week, in fact, for many weeks that first part of 1912, there was a general coal strike against every mine in Britain. He would not let his miners strike, and they didn't take kindly to this. In fact, to protest, they set the mine on fire. He himself put the fire out, and to this day, Pumpherston's website lauds James Congleton for putting out that fire. The miners also threw bathtubs down the shaft, and he had to pull them out. Now, with all that going on that week, do you think he got in a train and came down to see a relative? It just doesn't seem likely. You know, he was battling for his mind. Also, we can't find any connection between them genealogically. So it seemed like someone made up a good story. But solving the mystery of the watch accidentally helped me solve who took this photograph. And I believe it was this dapper gentleman spinning around here with his umbrella. This man is Jeremiah McVeigh. He's a member of Parliament. And he owns the Bansha, the hotel where they lived at 2 Upper Montague Street for that week. Mr. McVeigh lived in the Bansha himself. He lived in one of his 25 rooms, and his sisters ran it. Now, as a resident there, he would eat at the good table, so he would have, without a doubt, met the Caldwells, and certainly would have found out they were going to the Titanic. Well, this really interested him, because as a member of Parliament, he had to have a day job, too. He wasn't a full-time member, and his day job, if you can read this, is that he was a reporter for the Irish News of Belfast. His job was to report anything in the Greater London area that interested people in Belfast. Well, the Titanic was built in Belfast. The major employer in Belfast was a shipyard that built the Titanic. And I have no doubt that he heard that his two tenants were going to the Titanic, and he said, oh, goody, I'll go with you and see you off as your relative, thereby getting on the ship. Or maybe he already had his press credentials and was on the ship anyway. In any case, he could have taken their picture, and his sisters who ran the hotel would have without a doubt had their forwarding address. I believe it was Mr. McVeigh who took that terrible photograph that otherwise would have been thrown away, but otherwise has been very significant. Just to show you that we didn't solve every mystery in time for the book, we found these little baby booties smashed flat amongst Albert's Titanic things. My theory is that Alden wore them off the Titanic. However, Alden himself said, I don't think I had anything on my feet. We don't know. He doesn't remember. He didn't remember. I did try them on my own son, Alden, when he was 10 months old, and they did fit. And I have been able to prove that they're from the right era, but were they on little Alden's feet? We may never know. I hope we do know someday. Now, if you want to hear Albert tell the story himself, you can go to parade.com, which has an audio file of Albert being interviewed at age 90 by my cousin Bill Romeiser. You can click, write Albert's name in the search box, Albert Caldwell, and click on the button, and you can hear him speaking. I also have that on my website. If you want my card, I'll find it. Hope I have some. Anyway, so I also have it on my website. And if you want to read what Sylvia said, Sylvia wrote a booklet in 1912 called Women of the Titanic Disaster, and it was only 12 pages long. We found out it's such a rare book that I have one of the two copies left. We found out it was that rare. My publisher said, well, let's put it up as an ebook. So you can buy it for 99 cents as an ebook and read Sylvia's own take about the women who were on the Titanic. Well, that's all I have today. Now, I know the bookstore would love for you to buy a copy, and I'd love to sign it. But I'd also love to take your questions. If anybody has any questions about the Cobalt or anything, let me know. Here comes Brian with our questions. How many people were on the Titanic? About 2,200, and of those, about 700 survived and 1,500 did not. Yes?
How long have you been working on this?
How long did I work on this book? You know, not very long. I actually wrote the Wings of Opportunity that came out in 2010. And when I write a book, I take one copy of the book and have all the people who are acknowledged signing it. And the blurber on the back of Wings was signing it when he said, too bad you didn't think to write about the Titanic, didn't you have a relative on it? So doing, the light bulb went off, I went running to my hotel room, we were at a conference, and emailed my editor and said, I have another book. And 2 weeks later he said, we'll do that book. This was February of 2010, he said, but you have to have it by October. So basically it was between February and October. Luckily I've known the story all my life, or I thought. By the time I got done researching, I realized I hadn't known it at all. Yes?
Are there any pictures for historical documentation of all those women who lost their husbands and what they did? How did they survive financially after that Titanic and their husbands are gone?
Yeah, she said, how did all those women survive, the women who lost their husbands, because in that era they didn't have any support other than their husbands. Most women had no education, didn't know what they were doing, and most of them were migrated to a new country. And Sylvia's booklet is wonderfully informative on that, and she's really proud because most of them are consoling themselves because if they had to go as a widow into a strange land, they'd rather be going to America than any other place because they hear that Americans are big-hearted and will take them in. Now, immediately after the Titanic, all these widows were well cared for. They were lavish with clothes and money and goods. Many of them went straight back to England and probably, you know, moved in with relatives, found another husband, whatever it took. Sylvia particularly follows the story of one family, the Colliers, who they had dinner with on the Titanic. And they lost their daddy. It was a mother and a little girl. And the mother resolved to go on to Idaho and open the fruit farm that they had planned to do to raise her little daughter. And that's as far as we know in Sylvia's book, but unfortunately it didn't work out because the mother had tuberculosis and died from it about a year later. So the little girl was orphaned. It went back to England and the little girl was orphaned and was brought up by relatives. So their story didn't have all that happy an ending, but you know, they all had different ways of coping, but we don't really know. Sylvia's is one of the more complete looks at the ordinary women, even though it's just 12 pages. Yes.
So how did the picture of Albert Caldwell stoking the engine get saved?
How did a picture of Al stoking the engines get saved? That, you know, it wasn't. The one I have up there was from the internet. Yeah, it wasn't. It went down with the ship. He always said, if I could only find my camera at the bottom, what a story it would tell. And I always keep hoping they'll find it. I mean, you never know.
What was the name of Sylvia's second husband who was a member of the
state? Oh, yes. What about Sylvia and her second husband? Well, as a sort of a brief rundown of the Caldwell family, right after the Titanic, Albert went on the Chautauqua circuit and, you know, spoke about the Titanic. Then he became a school principal, went back to a school at Iowa State where Connie Bear was teaching, so they renewed their friendship. And he got more schooling, was a school principal there. Then briefly after that job came to an end, he sold cars, and I know that's when he discovered he was a good salesman, but he went on to become a school superintendent. But suddenly in the middle of the 20s, they resurfaced in Bloomington, Illinois, where Sylvia was working for State Farm, and she was the 11th person hired by State Farm. So it was a brand new company. She was one of the first ones in the door. Albert was working for Massachusetts Life, but she got him his job at State Farm, and he moved over to State Farm, where he stayed for the rest of his career. Well, by the time they divorced, Sylvia was the secretary to G.J. Mahurl, the founder of State Farm, and Albert moved away, married my aunt, and some years later, Mrs. Mahurl, who was an invalid, died, and a year and a half later, Sylvia married G.J. Mahurl. So she became the queen of State Farm, the queen of Bloomington, dripping in furs and jewels. She was very happy and very wealthy.
Other questions?
Yes.
As far as artifacts, where can you really find the most? And you said something about Philadelphia, like things from the Titanic.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she's asking about where you can find the most artifacts from the Titanic. There's a traveling exhibit that goes around the country, and the one I mentioned in the book, I think, maybe I tell it to you personally, it was traveling through Philadelphia at some point. But right now, the traveling exhibit, there are like four of them at any given time, and there's one in Atlanta right now, one in Raleigh, North Carolina, And it has been in Kansas City, it has been in Nashville, it has been in Birmingham. I think there's one in San Diego right now. But there are four of them that traveled around, and those are probably the best for artifacts because they actually show things that were brought up from beneath. You know, things that actually came up from the Titanic. And they're very dramatically displayed and really interesting to see, I think. And some people are offended because they were brought up from a wreck and where people died. So, you know, it's a personal taste issue, I suppose, but they're really dramatic and really bring it home to you. Now, there are also two permanent Titanic museums that are made to look like the Titanic. One is in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, and one is in Branson, Missouri. Haven't been to those, but they don't use artifacts from the bottom. They use artifacts, from my understanding, is they use artifacts from the families. And they have just contracted with me to have Alden's baby shoes there and a painting that Alden did when he was about middle-aged that he made for a gift for his daddy. And then a lot of our family photographs that you've just seen because they're going to honor the Titanic children in 2013. So they'll have a lot of the artifacts from the children who survived the Titanic and what they did with their lives and what went on with them. So Alden's baby shoes will be on display for, I think, 2 years in Pigeon Forge. So I've had to put them in the box and mail them away. That was really hard to do, but you know, it would be kind of fun if they're on display.
Other questions?
So they didn't find your gold or your gold coins?
So they didn't find my gold. You know, these artifact exhibits have some gold coins, and in every one of them, my sisters and I would say, hey, those are ours! And you know, they have never yet smashed the case to give them to us. You know, they don't believe us. But unfortunately, we found out that, well, I didn't know this was unfortunate until my husband told me so, shame on him, that the Caldwells collected insurance on the lost money. So my husband says, I hate to tell you, honey, but if they found the gold, you don't own it because they already collected the insurance. So shh, don't tell. I imagine they'd look for their great-grandson and give them back too if they found it. But I don't think we know what cabin they're in. We know they're in the stern, and they say the stern is in pretty bad shape and hard to get artifacts out of. But I don't think we know for sure what cabin they were in. That would be the only way for them to know. I don't know, maybe if they opened the trunk and had the trunk have their name on it, they might know that way. Yes?
What made you decide to name your son Alden?
What made me decide to name my son Alden was because of the book. Well, actually, because of the Alden Caldwell, not the book hadn't been written yet. My older son is Weston, and he was named for my husband's grandmother, whom he greatly admired, and he always vowed that he would have his grandmother was Annie Weston. He vowed that he would have a son someday named Weston. So we're expecting our second child. We decided we had to shake the family tree and get a good name out of it. And when we shook it, it came out Alden, which was, you know, I thought, for our Titanic family, which was a great reason. Didn't know Alden Caldwell very well. We thought about Albert, but it sounded a little old-fashioned next to Weston. We thought it sounded kind of funny, so we thought Alden blended better. Yes?
So what happened to Alden?
So what happened to Alden? That's a very good question. I think Alden probably suffered the most from the Titanic, even though he didn't remember the people screaming. He didn't have any of that kind of issue. As one of the last living survivors, because he was an infant, he was often tracked down by reporters who would say, you know, tell us about the Titanic, and he would have to say, I don't remember it, I was a baby, I slept through it, you know, that kind of thing. But when he graduated from college in the middle of the Depression, he wanted to get a job with the United States government as a chemist, which he was qualified for. He applied, but he was told he had to be able to prove he was an American citizen, and all his birth records had gone down with the Titanic. He could not prove he was an American. So Sylvia was writing him an affidavit to explain this when he got another job, and he stayed in that job, in that company, for the rest of his career. In the early 70s, he retired, and that was the only time I ever actually met him face to face. But he went to get his Social Security, and he discovered he was not allowed to get it because he could not prove he was American. And so Uncle Al, at that point, thankfully was still living, was able to write him a really complicated, long affidavit giving the birth and death dates and places of everybody and their family for generations back, so it was a great boon to me as a researcher, but, you know, pointing out that everybody in this poor little baby's family was American, and this little baby was born of American parents who just happened to be on missionary service in Siam, and all his birth records went down on the Titanic. And at this point, my husband always would say, oh yeah, I bet the official in Washington who read that thought, that's like the dog ate my homework. Yeah, right. Your birth records went down on the Titanic. Come on. They did agree with it, and finally when Alden retired, he was declared an American citizen.
Did you say you had different...
A different answer to what?
You said you had 13...
Oh, I have a bunch more talks, yes. She asked, do I have more talks to give? I am giving them all over the country. If anybody can bring me to a place, I will give a talk there. So I have a webpage. I should find my card if I have any, and give you a card so that you can, if you want to follow me around the country, certainly can. You can find me somewhere.
Well, on that note, we'll call it to a close, and it's now time for our Mark Prize.
Thank you.
And we'll be setting up a table up here, Shawn, if you get the books at the back. Well, for a copy of this fabulous book, which I reviewed for the Daily News last week, and it really is a wonderful story. Unlike most Titanic stories, it tells you the before and after. If you'll hold that, we'll get one of these people. How would you like to draw one out here for us? And the lucky person is Haley Rigsby. Haley?
Haley,
all right. And just write a little token of our appreciation for the author.
Well, like Albert, we have lost all our gold. But we have not lost the joy of having you tonight.
Oh,
this
thank
was
you
so,
so
much fun. Supper was fun, and this was fun.
Oh, I've had a ball. I've had an absolute ball. Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
I'll look it up.
Thank you.
Well, on behalf of the friends of WKU Libraries that sponsor our event, our genial host here at Barnes & Noble, we want to thank you, the author, for coming down to Birmingham and telling a wonderful story. We want to thank you, the audience, for making a fun evening for us all. And we hope you'll rejoin us in February, when we'll be doing another faraway place with strange-sounding names. Thanks and good evening.